Welcome back to Scoreheads, the podcast that celebrates the music of your favourite films, TV shows and video games by going behind the scenes of the composing industry and having in-depth conversations with those that make the notes that emote. I'm John Brown, the resident film correspondent at Express FM and presenter and producer of their film music programme, The Composer Series, as well as co-host and producer of our other film podcast on this very channel. We're going to need a bigger pod. Joining me for each Scoreheads episode is my good friend, film music journalist Sean Wilson, who himself is the author of the excellent book, The Sound of Cinema, Hollywood Film Music from the Silence to the Present. For this week's show, we're set to soar as one of the masters of making the music for Flight. The iconic and multi-award-winning Hollywood film composer John Powell joins us on this all-new Scoreheads. He's a British composer now residing in Los Angeles and is known for his incredible work on well over 70 feature films. Initially starting out as part of Hans Zimmer's Media Ventures, now Remote Control Productions, John worked and collaborated on a number of now well-loved animated scores, including DreamWorks' Ants, Chicken Run and Shrek with Harry Gregson-Williams, and The Road to El Dorado with Hans Zimmer, as well as feature films such as Face Off and Forces of Nature. He then went on to make his own mark in the film music space with outstanding work on the scores for the Jason Bourne films, Robots, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, the Ice Age sequels, X-Men The Last Stand, Kung Fu Panda, again working with Hans Zimmer, Night and Day, the Rio movies, all three installments of the groundbreaking How to Train Your Dragon, The Call of the Wild, Solo, A Star Wars Story, and many, many more. Recently, he's been celebrated and praised for his inventive work on scores for films like Don't Worry Darling, the beautiful and heartwarming Still, a Michael J. Fox movie, and the film that's currently entertaining families in cinemas across the UK, Illumination's Migration, seeing our maestro return to writing for Flight in the animated storytelling realm. His name is John Powell, and he joins Sean and I on this new episode of Scoreheads.
This is awesome.
Oh, maybe we should go say hi.
Hey there.
Dax talked to a girl.
A girl?
He wants to marry her.
What? I didn't say that.
You said it with your eyes.
What?
He's hitting me, he's hitting me.
They must be migrating.
Migration? What a stupid idea.
Okay, you're impossible.
Because I found a safe place for us to live.
I want us to get out and see the world.
What sort of father would I be if I put my young child in harm's way for no reason except a chance at a Caribbean vacation?
I don't want to miss out on life because you're afraid to leave this pond.
And Sean and I are incredibly pleased now to welcome back to the show the musical master craftsman behind the score to the incredibly fun animated feature Migration, multi-award-winning composer, Mr. John Powell. How are you, sir?
Very good. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. It's great to have you back on. I think last we spoke, we were just saying off air, we talked about How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World. I mean, that's a score I'm still listening to very, very often, along with the first and the second, of course. And now we find ourselves returning to the animated world with this fantastic new film from Illumination. It's a great family caper. What was it about the project that attracted you to it, and how did it come your way, John?
It was a kind of a last-minute thing, not from when we scored, but I suddenly got a call from Chris Meledandri, who I'd worked with many times since the days of doing Robots and the first few Ice Ages and things. He ran animation at Fox in those days. So I'd done a load of films with him. Then I did The Lorax with Illumination. I hadn't seen him in a little while, but I think he just called, I think, before last Christmas, not as in this Christmas past, but the one before. And that's when he told me, you know, who was directing as well. And that became a very attractive proposition. I mean, Benjamin's films are beautiful and incredibly funny. And so I was keen to talk to them. And it just proved to be a sort of a good match, I think. They needed somebody. I mean, I think Benjamin needed somebody who was going to be creative, but also could bring the size that the imagery was suggesting as well. His films are normally so intimate that it was something that was a bit of a requirement, I think. The vistas and flying and things like that, I probably suggested my name. But as I said, Chris Meledandri and I had done so many things together. I think that's mainly that's the real reason.
Scoring for Flight, I imagine, is that one of the
most brilliant things that you can do as a composer to really give that uplift to the audience.
Yes, it's funny. I've never done like a... I'm sure you guys know, but there was a famous British composer called Ron Goodwin who, you know, they used to say about him, if it flies, get Ron. You know, and... So, but that was a lot of kind of war films and things.
Yeah, where eagles dare and things. Yeah. Yeah.
633 Squadron. But he also did, you know, those Magnificent Men and their flying machines as well. But I think there's something about these flying shots in some of these animated movies that are always very joyful. And so I always loved doing anything like that. You know, my favorite sort of classical pieces of music are incredibly joyful. I don't tend to be that attracted to some of the darker things. So anything that's happy, joyful, dancing, you know. And I think being in the sky, there's often the imagery of, either has beauty, joy, and a lot of dance in a way. There's a lot of kind of choreography goes on in these scenes to make them fun.
What's the secret to... how to phrase this? Like, I always say that for us as an audience, it's like you make it fly and make us cry. That's the power of your music, especially with things like How to Train Your Dragon and with this and with Migration. It's stunning. It's beautiful. Like, what is the secret to not only scoring Flight, but also giving it so much emotional scope and depth?
I don't know. I mean, you're talking about sort of the basics of music, really. I think a lot of animation is a little descriptive, and part of how it goes. And it's funny, people complain about animation music because it's too descriptive. Then if you go back, you can look at the end of the 19th century, where a lot of programmatic music was described as being light and meaningless because it sort of had a story in it, as opposed to just an intellectual kind of... Sturm und Drang, you know, where clearly it was about the heart. Whereas, you know, some of the most beautiful music I think that's ever been written is, even if suggested just by titles or a story that, you know, that the composer was thinking about, or whether it's ballet music, where there literally was a story. I mean, I dare anyone to say that Rite of Spring hasn't got some of the most joyful music in it, even though it's a kind of not really a joyful story. So I read music a certain way. It makes me react a certain way. So I probably am always trying to put that programmatic element in, which is more than just description, but has a kind of the subtext. I mean, that's what we're supposed to do with music. It doesn't always work.
I remember when I first interviewed you, John, a few years ago now, you cited that you had a lot of admiration for the animated music medium because it's able to zip around and mash lots of different genres and lots of different stylists together, and it maybe offers that kind of creative latitude that maybe other genres of film music maybe don't do that. Do you still feel that there is a lot of creative expression within animation?
Oh yeah. I mean, again, it's like how over the years I'm trying to temper my Mickey Mousing a little bit, but I do enjoy switching a lot. I think it's ADD based. I kind of get bored. I get bored with, you know, with a long film that's a long live action film where it's all just the same kind of tone. I mean, it's easier to do in theory. It's hard to find the right tone in the first place, but then once you've got it, then you kind of, you know, you're fine. So animation is exhausting to do because there's all the changes and shifts. But I think I have tried to write music, which is if you turn the sound down, this came from George Miller as well. It's like he was used to say to me, if you could turn the sound down and then we still know what the story is, then maybe that we've got it right. So, you know, in animation, there's a lot of shifts in the story, and it's not just about describing what you're seeing. I mean, that is one of the problems with animation music, is when it sounds like, oh, there's a funny scene going on, so the music is funny. Do you really need to just be funny, or is there something else you can say? Or it's a set, or you suddenly realize that you obviously realize the character's in peril, so you kind of have to tend to do peril music. How hard you hit that, I think, should be about, and it changes over the decades and the eras as to how we treat the audience, how smart we think the audience are, or how much help they need. And so there's all these tone things that have changed in animation. I mean, I think Finding Nemo really shifted everything in my head a lot, because it was so, even though I think they forced poor Tom Newman into doing some of the Mickey Mousing that he'd never done before, and he does it brilliantly in it. A lot of the joy of that comes from him, you know, just finding the subtext and sticking with that a little bit more, and there's the beauty in that. But I think I am a creature of who gets bored real quick, and so anything where I have to keep doing different things is, you know, keeps me up.
What kind of conversations were you having with your director on this particular project about how the music should sound for Migration?
A couple of things. I mean, he, even though you wouldn't know from his sort of films, he's a huge classical music fan, and he almost kept it hidden from me for the longest time, because I think he finds classical music to be incredibly emotional, and I don't think he doesn't like trying to put the emotion front and center. And so I think he was worried about that. But we did have conversations early on. I obviously mentioned, you know, things like the duck in Peter and the Wolf. The color of that is really interesting. It's a beautiful piece of characterization of what I can only describe as a very tight-assed kind of animal. it's kind of got this little, it's like slightly whingy, but then when the duck's being chased by the wolf, it gets very kind of, it's the oboe is fabulous for kind of the it's like there's no other instrument that sort of has, it doesn't sound like a quack, but you can make it sound more duck-like, especially in the lower registers. So that was one thing we talked about. I mean, you know, he definitely wanted something very odd for the pigeons. He wanted, and important things, I think, were discussing the fact that they were ducks. So every place other than their own home that they came upon, they had no idea what it sounded like. It was just a foreign world to them. So New York was a bizarre alien landscape. So if we made it sound like, oh yeah, this is New York, it's like, well, that's from our perspective. That's not from the duck's perspective. So every time we did that, I mean, obviously when they were in New York, they're in a salsa club, but that's just a sort of a side effect. the rest of New York had to be treated as if it was, you know, a world unto itself. For the longest time, they did have something, you know, when we fly through Times Square, they had kind of jazz for Times Square, you know, that kind of big band Broadway. It sounded like Broadway, and it's like I fought it. I fought it because I said, look, your theory I think is right, which is they don't know this is, you know, they don't know these are neon lights. They don't know the neon lights lead to Broadway, to a show, to somebody doing a showstopper. That doesn't make any sense in their world. They see a you know, an unusual misty place as they come into New York. And they could be anywhere, you know, it could be on Mars. But by the time they've got through the Central Park and made friends with a pigeon, it's all about the joy of New York. So again, that's another piece of me just trying to represent what the wonders of life sound like. As if you don't know that it's New York, and you have no specific connotations. Obviously, I'm using Western music, I'm using, you know, Western harmony, that kind of thing. So I'm not a million miles away, but it was some very specific ideas that he had that led me to kind of find a very true course, I think, through the movie. And it was quite difficult for him. He hadn't obviously had a composer many times before, and they tend in France to sort of be very low budgets. So, you know, there's not a lot of time to play, and also not a lot of a chance to use a big orchestra, and choir, as we did as well. So he was understanding the variety of things we could try, and he was a little shy about it, I think, at first. But we got there in the end. It was, I think, wonderful fun for me to see him enjoying himself.
Just imagine the creative discussion. Like, so ducks don't listen to jazz, so we don't need to code it. We don't need to code it with like human stylistics. I mean, maybe they do listen to jazz, but maybe they react to it.
I mean, they don't listen to that they listen to anything that makes them happy, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, it's true. The specifics of our connections. That's all I mean.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, on the subject of the sort of mimetic, like quacking, I mean, was that, I mean, irresistible thing? You're doing an animated film, family film, there are ducks involved. Was there inevitably a draw to doing that kind of mimetic sound effect like device through the music? So for those who haven't listened to the score yet.
There is a moment. Yeah, there is a moment. And well, there's two moments. And the thing is that the only people, the only characters who talk in the movie are animals. The humans just grunt. So there's no human dialogue in it whatsoever. They are the animals in this film. So we very strictly kind of were going to stick with that. But I couldn't help myself. And so I bought a bunch of calls, duck calls, and then tried to play them in different pitches. And I tried a few things, and it was all way too stupid. So I put that aside. And then we'd finished the film, finished writing, and we were in recording with the choir, the women, and at some point we got to one of the cues where they were doing kind of like little sort of swingle singers kind of things, and we did all the passes, we'd finished it, and then one of the singers said, my daughter said, would I be quacking on this movie? And I said, well, all right, well, let's try it. So then we got them to quack, and they had good time, and I thought it was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard, and thought, there's nowhere I can do that. And that at that moment, literally in the session, I discovered that the director had been listening in from France. And so I was getting these text messages from him going, no, it's good, keep it, it's good, I love it. So that came. And then there was one moment when I literally sort of, I often finish writing about 3 minutes before I get in the car to go to the sessions, or in this case, to fly to London to record it. And I was literally finishing the last cue, which was just up to what we knew would start the end credits. And I just nailed it, and I got it. And I couldn't think, there was a space. I was like 1.5 seconds space, and I could not think of anything. And I rewrote things, and I tried to. And then it just occurred to me, what if in that space I did a duck call? So I just got the duck calls out. I found the one in the right key, and I just did there. And it made me laugh. And it's right before Benjamin's. So it's like honk, and you see Benjamin.
Yeah.
And I thought that might make him laugh, and it did. So that was me on a duck call, except it wasn't, because when we got to the dub, the brilliant guys up at Skywalker had some fantastic calls. And we sat on the dub stage going through about 17 different like duck honks for that moment, and we found the perfect one. And that's actually, and then I put that back in the soundtrack. So it is on the soundtrack album, and it's in the film, that moment. But that was the only, those were the only two sort of like falling into the abyss of sort of sonic self-abuse.
Sonic self-abuse.
Great turn of phrase.
That must have been just so much fun, though, in terms of like, and lots of laughter, I guess. That's the more fun side of it, I guess, doing just, you know, playing around with random ideas like that. But I mean, were there any other moments like that across this process, you know, where you say, we have these moments during the writing or the production of a score where you have a happy accident, or a wrong note turns out to be the right one, or you build a new instrument to get a certain sound? Were there any other moments like that across the course of creating this score, writing this score?
That's how it's all done.
I've been literally winging it.
Yes, I mean, it's very appropriate for a duck yeah. flying movie to say that I wing it a lot, but I do. No, I mean, all the music I write is created by play. Nothing. There's nothing really terribly dogmatically sort of functional other than starting. That's the hardest bit. So you start, it's all rubbish, you mess around, it's still rubbish, and then every now and again something just catches your ear. And then you just keep going until you've got 10 things that have caught your ear, and then you start to develop those. And making sounds is an interesting thing that I have done many times. I think I'm lucky to be in the world of sampling since the beginning of my career, so that's always been a joy, because you different sounds give me different inspirations, I suppose. They inspire you to write differently. They inspire a different harmonic language or a different melodic language or colors, textures. So, yeah, playing around with sounds. I mean, for the pigeon with the bum leg, very aggressive one, that's just a kora, which is an African harp, which is actually sort of a step. But I didn't really do it like that. I was just messing around with I have strange instruments as well I've got over the years, and I have different ways of playing them. So, you know, whether it sticks or plucking strangely, or in this case, it was a steel, which you normally use for bottleneck or steel guitar. And so you would never use that you couldn't use it on a harp because you couldn't get to the notes. But the way that the kora is laid out is the harp notes that kind of go around a big bridge, so you can actually get to them. And so it was just kind of like playing around with that and going, if the word in the spotting session had been, you know, we need something a bit wonky, you know, it's just, tried it over the years, probably on many instruments, and, you know, you get different things, basses and, but you're kind of common, those glisses are common on lots of instruments.
Yeah.
And this was the first time I'd heard it where it doesn't sound like anything I've heard before. And so that would be an interesting thing. So, and it's not like I did it to the character. I do it, again, mess around for 20 minutes, record everything, and then just go in and cut it up and make a set of samples that interest me. You know, it's like, here are the 25 most interesting kind of bits of 20 minutes around. I know it doesn't sound very technical or sort of studied or, you know, intellectual, but it's how I think, it's how you keep being, you keep the music sounding joyful because you're having fun yourself. Otherwise, it was really just sort of sitting down and having to work in the office every day.
You mentioned like sort of speciality instruments or instruments that might appear to be relatively more exotic outside of the standard symphonic setup. Is it a case of you highlight the need for something, knowing that there is going to be somebody available to play it? Because I mean, I imagine, does it take quite sort of rarefied sort of abilities on the part of instrumentalists to play some of these instruments, given how commonplace they are?
Yeah, it depends what you're playing. It's like, and sometimes I do it myself because I can, and through the joy of editing and taking it a million times and then editing it down, or to tell you the truth, sampling. It's like the very first Dragons when we did the bagpipes. I knew I couldn't survive with the 7 notes that a bagpipe can play, maybe 9. But in a scale that's hard and to fit, and I wanted things on them. So I got 20 bagpipers, and I did a set of samples. And so it's not the real instrument, but it sounds like the real instrument. And that's something that we can do at the moment. The second and third film, I managed to find, thanks to Pat Doyle, a brilliant bunch of guys in from Edinburgh, I think they are, and they they have in ways, including using, what do you call it, sort of not CNC machines, like, you know, 3D modeling. They make 3D modeling to add to the chanter to get weird holes and things in different places so they can get extra notes. And so we managed to get number 2 and number 3 played. But the first one was like that. And it depends. If there's something that I know can be played and I don't want to sit there and try and do it, or I literally can't do it. I mean, there's obviously many instruments I can't play. I'll think very carefully about how that goes. But other than that, having lots of weird instruments, or being able to buy them or rent them, bring them in to my own studio and play around, and I basically can play almost any instrument really badly. So that gives me some access to at least the sound of it. I cannot get past that point where you would want to play something to anybody else. It's a very private thing. It's like, I have a lock on the door when I'm doing this stuff. It's like, nobody's going to come in when I'm trying this out because it sounds terrible. But at the end of the day, a lot of the weirdest things I've ever done have been me in a strange moment of luck. You know, and it's a numbers based thing, so it could be that you get 3 really interesting bits out of 1,000 gestures on an instrument. And And so it's more about editing and it's more about picking the right bits. And then even then, sometimes it's about manipulating it further. So it's just part of the inspiration of playing with it. You know, obviously, if it's something like, you know, flute things, that there are amazing flute players in the world who can grab a Banshiri sort of flute, and even if you haven't written it in the right key, they'll figure out how to get it into the right place for you. Or you use something that isn't actually the instrument you were using. It's a different instrument, but it sounds similar, or it sounds more interesting, and it's in the right key. So there's a lot of studio production goes into that. But you can't sort of sit there with an orchestra and all these weird instruments all playing at the same time and expect it to be anything other than complete chaos. It would. And so you never do it like that. I mean, a lot of really interesting music has been done by that, and I sort of don't have the guts to do it because I know how much money it costs. And if you're burning money, you have to be really confident of what you're doing. Whereas, given that almost everything is done to click, it means we can layer everything. I think probably one of the biggest inspirations to me early on in my musical life was not just Brahms and Tchaikovsky, but was also Peter Gabriel IV, where all these amazing sounds were layered and you didn't know. And there's a lot of organic things that were processed. You know, he was one of the first people to have a Fairlight and was doing things that nobody else could figure out how he was doing it. And I've always loved that. So.
Was that you playing the guitar on the Migration soundtrack? Someone's shredding.
Yeah, some of it. It depends which bit. Some of it may have even been programmed. I keep some stuff. If I can program it well enough with samples to just sound really, really good, or I just have players do it. And, you know, I mean, it's a lot of these things sometimes in something you hear and it sounds like, oh, that's just one guy playing this. It might be three techniques used, a bit of me, a bit of them, and a bit of samples, and you'll never really know.
I absolutely thought that was you. So, yeah.
I mean, I can't remember. I mean, there's a few bits, maybe, but it's a mixture of people, definitely a mixture of people and programming and luck, mainly.
And that's the magic. I never knew. Look at that.
Well, if we're continuing the who was playing it question, I've got to ask about the kazoos on Chicken Run, which everyone of our generation remembers, which was just a brilliantly devious and brilliant injection. What was the story behind that? Who was performing those?
Well, I think this was back when Harry and I were at Media Ventures, as it was called, now Remote Control, with Hans. And I think I had a streak of, you know, at the beginning of really trying to be as subversive as possible. I think I did it because I knew it sort of amused Hans. And, you know, because when you're part of a group where there's a sort of a sound to the place, and this goes for Harry as well, is like we were always aware of the fact that we got a chance because of being able to sort of fit in with what was expected because of Hans, but also you couldn't help yourself, so you wanted to sort of poke at it and see if you could find your own voice. And I think Harry and I did that a lot at the beginning there, but you had to be careful because if you go too different from the sort of the prescribed route, you do get into trouble. So Chicken Run was, but Chicken Run by that time, I think Jeffrey had a bit of faith in Harry and I, cause we'd done Ants, and we got to a point where I think, you know, in discussions, I don't know why, but it just popped into my head something like how irritating a sound it would be. And I think there must have been a description. I mean, it's so long ago, I never remember exactly what it was, but I have a feeling that it was, you know, when you spot the movie, when you talk about the movie, there would have been words that would have jumped up. And, you know, imagine a word cloud where something keeps popping up. And the only connection I could possibly make to that word would be, kazoos. That's totally kazoos. It's like, you know, it's just, I don't know, irritating, buzzy. I mean, somebody said buzzy at the same time as irritating and unusual. And then you just put those connections together and then think. So obviously in everybody had done, there's been kazoos on a few things probably before that, but I didn't remember anything with an ensemble of kazoos. Simply because, well, why would you? So we got I think we got every assistant, every composer, every we could into one of the rooms in at Media Ventures. I bought a bunch of kazoos and we did some samples of everybody. And of course, these are not singers, but everybody's a musician, so you could sort of get them to hit the note. And then we just did some basic samples to try it out. And I think we then had a meeting where we put that in a queue. And I do remember Jeffrey. It was sort of, he knew who to insult. It passes, it goes, and you get to the end of the queue, and he turned to me, he goes, "That was you, pal, wasn't it?" So he liked it. He laughed at it, which is very, it's very hard to make Jeffrey laugh. If you've made Jeffrey laugh, you've done it. That's a sort of a really extremely effective joke. I mean, he probably was worried about it being too stupid, too much. I don't know. But the thing about Chicken Run was that the irony was that it was the most British film. Yeah. And Harry and I would never have got on it were it not for the fact that we were connected to DreamWorks. Mm. And the fact that DreamWorks bought the production, as it were, for that film was just luck. Mm. Just completely sheer luck. So we're surrounded by Americans here who are like puzzling about this film. So I think Harry and I probably, it was a bit like falling off a log for us, because there was just a sense of humor that was aligned naturally over centuries of stupidity, of British stupidity, that just all fitted with it. So we were able to kind of just resonate with what Nick and Pete were doing in England, and all the Americans were just like, "Oh, well, let them get on with it." They seem to understand it.
Jeffrey laughed. Did Hans laugh? Did he? Was he?
Yeah, I was going to ask that.
Yeah. Hans laughed. It's funny. It's obviously the age-old joke about, you know, Germans and humour. I would say that Hans is one of the funniest people I know, and has one of the most acute sense of humours. So, but I think he was even probably worried. Waiting, I think it's one of those things where it's like, unless the top guy in the room laughs, nobody else laughs.
It's like a cascading effect.
Yes. So once Jeffrey laughed, I may be overstating that. He may have just smiled, which would probably have been enough. And once we'd done that, once we got through the demo stage, then when we got to London, we had a choir of women. It wasn't that many, just 12, maybe something like that. And so we just gave them. We bought a set of the pretty good ones. The good ones were about £4 each, as opposed to the bad ones, which were about £1 each. So, and we got that, and they were both abused. You always have this thing of everybody like, which end do I blow? What do I do? You know, and then people blow through it, and they don't realize that all it does is it's just a resonant. It's a resonant read. That's all. You don't actually get the note. You have to sing the note. So there were a bunch of singers, so that's why it was great once they realized how to play it.
What are your reflections? I mean, that's just one of many, I guess, but those, how do you look back on those times now with DreamWorks and working with Harry on films like Shrek and so forth? What are your kind of thoughts and memories that come to the forefront of your mind now looking back on it?
It's one of those periods of your life where a lot of luck on my part, a lot of luck that I got to work with Hans, and then from Hans to Harry and on those films and things. So it's a very fond memories. I do remember it being tough because there's so much pressure. Shrek was a really important film for DreamWorks. There's a possibility that it would have finished the studio if that hadn't have been such a hit. Mm. So it was difficult because, I mean, I remember the first time Harry and I saw it in the little theatre at DreamWorks. I remember thinking, oh, yeah, this works. This is no problem. This is going to be easy because it just works so well. Mm. And then it was so hard. And it took me years to realise when when there's enough pressure on everybody else around you, you cannot persuade people that they should just relax because it's going to work. Mm. You know, mm-hmm. And that's a very, very bad... It's a very bad, you know, sort of reaction. They'll have bad reactions to that, you know. And it's the one that, as Jeffrey said, you know, kind of got me benched for a while from DreamWorks, because I was kind of, I was not understanding the sort of the the desperation, I think, that was around me. I was just kind of a little blithe about it, rather than sort of... It was years later I realized you have to join people in the madness a bit. Otherwise, they think you're against them. Of course, I wasn't against them. I wanted the movie to be as good as possible in it, but I knew it was working. So you kind of... You just try things. And then when somebody says, you know, could it be 1 millimeter to the left? No, 1 millimeter to the right. No, could you go back 1 millimeter? Maybe half a millimeter. This, when you get into these kind of things, and you, at a certain point, you, and I think I was just about to have my son, so I was kind of like a little edgy, you know, and it kind of ruined my relationship with everyone there, and so that's why I went off a little. I took my own path a little after that. So,
just to spiral it back to migration, John, you mentioned earlier this is something, the idea of when one scores comedy, are you inclined to make it funny? Is that, you know, so this is something that on this podcast we've brought this up quite a lot. The idea of like scoring humor seems like a very, very difficult thing to do. It's like, do you overemphasize it or do you go beneath it and score it from within?
Yeah, there's so many different sort of arguments in different ways, and it's been tried so many times, obviously the first thing is, the first rule would be thou shalt not ruin the comedy. That's the main thing. It would be better not to have music than have music that kind of kills jokes. But I think a lot of it is about tempo and time and sort of what the nature of the music is. You know, there can be fun music and there's funny music, and they're very different.
Yeah.
I try and use the word charm, just sort of musically being charming in the background, just to let everyone relax. It's just like, so you're telling everyone, there's no other subtext here other than just enjoy the banter.
Hmm.
So sometimes you do that but then you get into the details of characters can do things that, if you do support them a certain way, it can heighten the comedy.
Mm.
But you have to be very careful about that, because it can be very irritating to an audience to be kind of, or at least now, again, it's the stuff that is very beautifully done in, you know, all of these classic Disney movies. But now you feel like, well, why are you telling me what I already know? You know, it's like the slightly crazy pigeon in Migration is like, did I really need to sound wonky? I mean, the voice is amazing, and Awkwafina is just doing this brilliant voice.
Yeah.
And the character's there, and the imagery is there, and the craziness of it is there. Did I really need to do that? But I'd like to think that it just sort of supported the... I mean, we were trying to make threat. So it was like trying to do a threatening sound where it wasn't too... It also gave the indication that that you'd be okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. A lot of it's tempering. Is things, you know, a lot of tone things in movies are tempering, and sometimes tempering, you do get asked sometimes, can you make it funnier? In other words, we wrote the script, we laughed at the script, we recorded it with the voices, we laughed at the voices, we put it together, we laughed. Now 6 months later, we're not laughing because we know the jokes. So then you get asked, it's like, well, can you make it funnier? And you have to try. I try and always remember the first time I saw it, and which I try and watch the film with no music whatsoever the first time. I always try and remember that. It's like, if I didn't think that was funny, then yes, I'm going to try and make it funnier for you.
Yeah.
If I thought it was hysterical, I'm not going to, because I think you've lost, as I will do in 6 months, you'll lose perspective on what is funny and what isn't. You get, because we will get bored with things. But that first time through is really important to me. I mean, it's literally the, I always tell people it's the most valuable I can be to you is to hold in my head what the emotional journey was, including whether it's funny, whether it's sad, whether it,
yeah,
you know, and the so then you're looking for the difference between what everyone wants it to be and what you felt about it. And obviously I'm only one person, but my view of what a film is all I've got, really.
Yeah.
So if I watch it, I find it incredibly funny. I'm not going to push hard. If it's not funny, I can definitely try some things. Tempos, that's when tempos become very important. It's like if it's slow and not funny, you can basically be very fast and charming and get people through it. Mm-hmm. Or if it's important, you slow down so that it doesn't, you're not pushing when you don't need to push, things like that.
Yeah, it's a restraint, I guess. Just one more question, John, because I know we're pretty much almost out of time. I did want to ask you about something I heard in that you were returning to the world of How to Train Your Dragon soon, I believe, this time for a live action version. Is that true? And how excited are you to be returning to that world, if it is?
I'm not quite sure what I can say, because, yes, obviously things are happening and there's always things going on with trying to sort of figure out good films for people. But, you know, I certainly feel that a live action version of the film directed by Dean can work very well.
Mm.
And I certainly feel that probably the score is going to have a lot of similarities, but it's still not going to be the same, because live action is very different. And again, for all the reasons we've talked about, there's things that happen in animation that but ironically, I think it would be done on the ground. That's where the changes would happen. I think the timing and the flow and of live action is different. So that tends to be on the ground. Once I think you hit the air, I mean, a live action Romantic Flight is probably going to look kind of quite similar to the animated Romantic Flight. So I think the joy of it and the beauty of it and everything else like that should match. And I don't know. I mean, all these things are somewhat up in the air, and I know that it's my job not to sort of give announcements. I don't know, but I hope so. Let's put it that way. I hope so, and I hope it will be as amazing and beautiful as I think it can be.
Perfect. John, thank you so much for your time. It's been great to have you back on. Good luck with everything you're doing next. Love Migration, and you have yourself a wonderful day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Look!
This isn't about migration. It's about adventure.
Whoa, 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 hey!
What just happened?
I don't know, but you're in trouble.
What is that?
Duck à la Ronge.
What's Duck à la Ronge?
It's you. With LaRange on top.
There's a whole world we've been missing out on.
And we...
When danger strikes, you do not run from it.
Reload!
We're going to finish this crazy, wonderful adventure.
You're so adorable.
Maybe I'll eat you.
I'm kidding.
Where am I?
Go, go, go!
And that brings us to a close for this week's show. Thank you so much to John and to Sean, and thank you too for listening. To get more details on John, check out his website, johnpowellmusic.com, and he's across all social media too. All of the music of John's that we discussed is available now, and our very special thanks again to Backlot Music for their support with this episode. Migration is in UK cinemas now. Great choice for the half-term break if you're listening around the time of the UK school holidays. You can, of course, see that at the View Cinema. Thank you again to our friends at View for all of their support. Check out their listings and get times and tickets for your nearest View at myview.com. And also, of course, the soundtrack to Migration is available on digital download via our friends at Backlot Music right now.
To get more updates from us, then by all means follow at Need a Bigger Pod on socials. I'm also at John Brown TV. That's J-O-N at John Brown TV on all platforms. Or you can follow Sean on X at Seano22. That's S-E-A-N at Seano22. Or Instagram at Sean Filmwriter. Until next time, thank you. And as always, keep on collecting those soundtracks.